Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Welcome. Chapter 14. So this is a little bit of a picture about Yeshayahu was talking about the fact that the people had sinned and that foreign nations would eventually conquer Eretz Yisrael, but setbacks are only temporary. That's the eternal Jewish way. In other words, we always believe in the future. In Hazorim B'dima Barina Yekseru, if you plant with tears, you'll eventually you'll reap with joy. And initially, we started out in the Garden of Eden and we blew it. And eventually, we'll work our way back and we'll have earned a living that's living in a world of heaven. But because we'll have earned it and because we'll have experienced what we have, it'll be a different experience, and that's the messianic times or future times. Along with that are the lessons that we learn and the lessons we pick up. Last week we learned a little bit about Babylonia, the handwriting on the wall. That was the country that had destroyed Eretz Israel. It had destroyed the first base Hamikdash, and So there would be retribution. In other words, there was an arrogance that the Babylonians had. And so out of nowhere, the Medes would come. The Medes were an ancient nation. And we were talking about how even today in the Middle East, you have these different nationalities, the Sunnis and the Kurds and the Shias. And their name, you know, what they call themselves changes, but you've always had these different peoples there. And at different times, one rules over the other. And they're always brutal to each other. They always come in and they massacre everybody else, and then they rule for a certain amount of time. And this has been happening throughout history, through those nations, between the Bedouins and the Medes and the Persians and the Arabs and they, you know, whatever you want to call them, the Sunnis and the Shias and the. But it's basically been these same tribal peoples from one empire to the next, and people are given their chance. They're given their moment in the limelight. And that's the chance to use it, and that's their opportunity. But here he comes back to the Jewish people, and he said, "Ki Yerachem Hashem es Yaakov." Hashem will take pity on Yaakov. Yaakov is the name of the Jewish people when they struggle. That's the name that he had with his brother when he struggled. The word Yaakov is like the heel. He was born with a heel on top because Esau came out first, and his foot was like on his brother. And that, you know, the Jew in exile is Yaakov. We have to, you know, have like the heel against us, or the struggling of Yaakov struggles his whole life. But Yaakov, his name is changed eventually to Yisrael, which means that eventually you'll overcome. And we don't ask for tests. We hope we don't have tests. We hope we don't have struggles. But the reality of life is that there are struggles. And we just hope that we will overcome the struggles, and that we will keep our faith and overcome them as Yaakov, as the Jewish people. If you look over here, it's interesting. It says Hashem takes pity on Yaakov, and he chooses Yisrael, which means that he takes pity on the Jewish people even when they're Yaakov was the. When Yaakov struggled, he had a constant struggle with his brother to see who would come out on top. And there's a tension, actually, in between the kingdom of Esav and the kingdom of Yaakov. They both had leaders. And the blessing was that when Yaakov does what he's supposed to, then he will rule over Esav. But when when Yaakov doesn't do what he's supposed to, Esav will rule over Yaakov. So over here, that hints to that Hashem will take pity on us as Yaakov, the one that's struggling, but he's going to choose Yisrael on a higher level. V'hanicham al admasim. And he's going to take and place us back on our land. It implies exactly what happened, that we were kicked out of our land, and he would bring us back. He would place us back on our land. Now, an interesting part of the story here, V'nilva hager aleihem, when we come back, we won't come back alone. We'll have a lot of converts that'll join us on the way. And I don't know percentages, but there in every Jewish community today, there are converts. There are converts everywhere you look. Many people aren't aware because most of the time, by the time we see them, they don't carry a sign. You know, I'm a kind of, you know, they look like, you know, like everybody else, especially, you know, the. But it implies that towards the end of time, that the converts will join the Jewish people. There is a view that that's one of the reasons why we were sent into the exile, that there are special souls scattered throughout the different countries that we go to. And if we wouldn't be in those communities, they would never have a chance to learn about Judaism. They'd never have who to go to convert. And so they manage to, Jews are in all corners of the earth so that these converts can join us, these righteous converts. And when the Mashiach comes, they will have come on board. The word used here is very interesting. It uses the word nisfahu. They'll be like added onto the house of Yaakov. So there's two ways to interpret an add-on. What's an add-on? So sometimes a tumor is an add-on. Nobody wants a tumor. That's not a good thing. It's like a growth. And then there's another kind of growth that's healthy, that means like they will benefit the Jewish people. And so there's a big debate in the Gemara, are the converts good for us? Now, let's go back. The second Beit HaMikdash was destroyed because of converts. And it's actually the sad ending to the Hanukkah story. Hanukkah, we talk about the beginning. The Chashmonaim were the great pious leaders who risked their lives for the Jewish people. And they started a monarchy, a leadership of the Jewish people. And it started off with great hope. And in the end, it was terrible. They degenerated, the kings, the descendants of the Maccabees. Where did it go wrong? How could that have happened? So there are different views. The main view that is heard is that in the Jewish people, we've always not concentrated all the power in one set of hands. We have the Kohanim, and we have the kings, and the priests, and the prophets. And whenever somebody tries to grab all of the power, whatever reason that they may have for doing so, it's not a healthy situation. And it could be in a time of war, people take unusual powers amongst themselves. Sounds familiar, like every dictator has taken unusual powers in a time of war. And the trick is, in a time of peace, to give it back. That's what happened in Egypt, and that's what Hitler did, Yimach Shemo, and what others do, is that they claim it's necessary to have these powers because there's anarchy, and there's war, and there's this, and there's that. And in some cases, it is necessary to have unusual powers. After 9/11, the government asked for powers to read everybody's email and to listen to our communications and to in order to prevent terrorism. And there were people that were afraid that they would abuse those powers. And you can argue whether they have or haven't or will or won't. But the nature of when you study history, whenever somebody grabs too much power, even if temporarily it's okay, and power corrupts eventually. And the Chashmonaim had that problem, that some people feel that in future generations the descendants weren't as pious as their forefathers were. And this happens too. In other words, children aren't always the same as their fathers. It didn't work. One of the things that happened was that the original Chashmonaim fought wars in order to keep the Torah. It was necessary to fight wars in order to save the Jewish people. The Greeks weren't letting us keep our Torah. So some of their descendants fought wars to make more money, to increase the boundaries. And when they fought those wars, they conquered foreign nations. And you can argue whether that's appropriate. You know, war is not a good thing. You know, even though they were good at it, they were leaders, they were fierce warriors, the Maccabees. When they fought the war of Hashem, it was one thing, but when they fought a war, strictly speaking, to enlarge Eretz Yisrael, that wasn't so good. And what happened was, they conquered different nations, and they didn't know what to do with them. And again, we have this issue today. What do we do with all the Arabs? Do we make a separate state? Well, we can't have an enemy against us. So their solution was, let's convert them. And so they converted the nations that they conquered, Now, these nations, if they conquered, were not interested in Hashem and being pious and good and righteous. But if a nation conquers you, you follow the religion of the conqueror. And one of those nations that they conquered was a warlike a very fierce tribe called the Idumeans. And they, on the outside, they started keeping kosher, they started keeping Shabbos, and they became part of the Jewish people. The Hashemites thought, great, we'll have a warrior class. We'll have people, you know, Jewish people, we don't like to fight in the army. We want to use our brains. How many Jews go to the military? So they figured they'll conquer the Idumeans, and they'll have people that'll serve in the military. This was a great move, the Hashmonaim thought. Now, part of the challenge was the sages told them it wasn't a good idea. We run into this all the time where people want, let's just relax the conversion standards. Rabbi, come on. And the rabbi says, no, it's not such a good idea, but people want it. You know, they want us to bring all these kinds of people in. And so what happened was they brought in these Idumeans, and within 50 years, the chief of staff was an Idumean named Herod. Actually, the chief of staff was Herod's father, Antipater. That was his name. They assassinated every single one of the royal house of the Hashmonaim, and they left one daughter alive, who they said she had to marry the slave of the house of Herod, who was the one of these Idumeans. And rather than marry and lend credibility to this slave who had butchered her family, she killed herself. This was one of the last daughters of Hashmonaim, and this was the Herod's wife. Wasn't really her wife. She never wanted to be his wife. To the point where today there's no living descendants of the Hashmonaim. That was the terrible end. You know, 100 years later. I mean, not the original Hashmonaim, but it turned out that it all came about because of Herod, who was a madman. He butchered people. He butchered all the Hashmonaim. He butchered his, caused his wife to jump off the roof. That was the one that he killed. And he killed millions of people. Maybe not millions, maybe tens of thousands. If you read about Herod, you can read about him in Josephus. He was, Christianity started because they, you know, Herod took him and nailed him up on the, you know, the wall or whatever. That was part of Herod's thing. You know, he was not a, not a nice person. You know, he had his family members assassinated. He killed his own kids, killed his wife. He was paranoid, schizophrenic, probably someone like this guy who did, you know, shot up the school, you know, just terrible butcher, you know. The Idumeans, this warrior nation, this very sick, brutal tribal nation that the Hashmonaim thought, well, you know, it'd be good. We'll have somebody to serve in the military. We need fierce people, people that don't mind killing to serve, you know, to fight our wars for us so we can go and study and go to shul. And the end turned it on the Hashmonaim and butchered a lot of Jews. And in the end, that led to the destruction of the temple. That was the, in a nutshell, that's what happened. And so those converts were not a good thing to add them to the Jewish people. We didn't need this tribe of vicious Idumeans to or the warrior class to join the Jewish people, and so that was not a good conversion move.
Did people consider him to be a Jew?
Well, he was a half Jew. He was converted with the Idumeans. He was part of that nation that the Hashmonaim brought on board. So there's always a question when if you look in the Book of Ruth. The question was that, you know, that Ruth was converted when she married her husband, who was Jewish, and then the mother converts her, mother-in-law makes her convert again. It's mothers-in-law; they're never happy with what the daughters-in-law do, right? That's the they made her convert again. Why? But there is always a question of motives. And a convert has to accept Judaism because they love Hashem. They accept Judaism because they love their husband, or because they'll advance in their life, or because it's the best choice open to them, but not that they love Hashem. There's a question whether the conversion is good. Now, there is a view that as long as eventually they come to love Hashem, that they become a good convert. There is a view like that. And if you remember, Hillel took converts. There was a convert in the Gemara in Shabbos mentions that he wanted to become the Kohen Gadol. He liked that idea of wearing all the nice robes. And he said to Hillel he wanted to convert because he wanted to run to be Kohen Gadol. And when he went to Shammai, Shammai threw him out. He said, you know, you'll never. And with Hillel, he said, okay, come study. And he converted him, he gave him a bris, and he went to, you know, went to the mikvah, and he studied. And then all of a sudden he finds out, in order to be Kohen Gadol, you have to be a Kohen. But by the time he found it out, he had fallen in love with Judaism. And they say Hillel was able to see that he eventually would accept it out of love. One of the rabbis' biggest fears is that rabbis do conversions, and a high percentage of them, the same way they jump into Judaism, they don't last. They jump out. And it's a, and it's wrong to convert people that it won't last. I've done conversions. It's very difficult. It's very difficult because people make changes in their lives, and especially when sometimes people convert as part of a relationship because their husband or their wife is Jewish, they become Jewish, and a high percentage of those marriages don't work because they're coming from different backgrounds. As much as they want to make them work. So 50% of those marriages won't work, and then when that marriage dissolves, that person, what's the chances that they want to stay Jewish? You know, or what's the chances that you did them a favor? And so there's, whenever there's a question about motives, there's a question of whether the conversion took, it didn't take, whether they're fully Jewish, they're not Jewish. So there is some question whether Herod is considered Jewish technically or not. But the question though is, and this is the question about this word, nispachu, that the converts will join the Jewish nation, will they be a cancerous growth on the Jewish nation, or will they be a positive growth on the Jewish nation? And the reality is that there's both. There's people like the Idumeans that joined the Jewish people and were the destruction of the Jewish people and were not good to the Jewish people. And then there are converts are righteous converts, or the Torah mentions. There is a view in the Gemara that the converts actually are not good because they make us look bad, because they're so sincere, and we take it for granted. You know, we're used to things that way, and they have they're new to Judaism. But it's just interesting. The Gemara that discusses it, it centers around this word in Hebrew, nispachu, and mine just translates that to accompany them. But it's really not really a good translation of that word. That word itself, like I said, if you say that there'll be a growth to the Jewish people, well, a growth. Nobody, cancerous growth or not. I mean, any kind of growth in the body that doesn't belong is not healthy. Any kind of growth in a positive way is healthy. So you have to know. So converts are like that too. They can be a growth in a very positive way, or they can bring in outside types of things that are not good, which, like we said, that ended up destroying the Hashmonaim. But it's predicting here that in Messianic times we'll have this growth. We'll have this big influence of non-Jews. And as I mentioned to you, it's surprising. The longer you get to know people, we accept converts, and we don't look at anybody. In fact, we a righteous convert. There's a mitzvah to love a righteous convert, but it doesn't. It's surprising sometimes. You'd be surprised at how many converts are around. Let's just put it that way. Yeah.
Well, I just want to clarify something for myself. So when Christians, or at least in their theology, say Jews killed their God, who are they talking about when they say the Jews killed him?
Well, they think the Jews turned him over to Herod, or turned him over to the
the Jews, and these were the ones who converted to be Jews.
Yes, and then there were the Romans, and Herod was involved with the Romans. He was the Romans were the superpower at that time, and so he did things to please the Romans and but they blamed the Jews for what happened, even though it wasn't physically the Jews that, you know, hung them up on the.
Dr. Laura was a.
Mm-hmm.
And she later
backtrack to a
thing. Converted or reverted or whatever.
Yeah.
Because she said the Jews were nice to her.
Well, she had a problem in that she's not. She was in media, and she wasn't a liberal convert, and so there are a lot of Jews in show business, and those Jews did not want a convert who was not liberal, and so they were vicious to her, and so, in other words, like, you know, she was more conservative type of convert, conservative meaning her views were conservative, and so there were liberal Jews who normally are very accepting of all kinds of people where, you know, who's this non-Jewish girl coming and telling us, you know, we're not, you know, our practice of Judaism isn't sincere and isn't right and isn't this and our views aren't right. And so a lot of them, especially in show business, were unusually harsh to her. I mean, even like the Republican Cantor, what's his name? You know, it's not easy. The vast majority of Jews are democratic and liberal, and when you're in certain fields, whether it be politics or whether it be show business, where the vast majority have other views, you know, they may or may not be so pleasant to them. But whatever. I think that's my belief. What happened there. So, at any rate, the Messianic times, there will be lots of converts. And so what we have to do, though, is when we live at a time when, you know, for many thousands of years, people would say, come back to the land of Israel. That hasn't happened in 1,000 years. What kind of dream is that? That'll never happen. We live in a time when it's happened. You know, we live where it's no longer a dream that Jews will come back to live in the land of Israel. You can get in a plane and go and be in Israel. You were just in Israel, right? So, and then that you say there was a time when a non-Jew would convert to be a Jew in Poland? That was unheard of. What non-Jew would want to be a Jew? Well, like I said, today you look around and there are a lot of people converting, and in Israel there are a lot of people converting. I just wanted to point out that some of the tension over what the conversion rules are, that's part of what's going on in Israel today, as who to accept and who not to accept. Do we want to be liberal about it? Is it a good growth, or is it a cancerous growth? Is it good for us to take in all these people that may or may not be so sincere? They brought the Russians into Israel, many of them who were not Jewish. In fact, the majority were not of the Russian Jews that came to Israel. To this day, it's debatable whether that was a good move, you know, or not a good move. Some people felt it was good. It brought in more professors and more doctors, even if they weren't Jewish. Long term, there'll be a big question whether that was the right. I mean, whether or not you agreed with what was done, there was a little bit of trickery. Calling them Jews when they weren't Jews was never correct. In other words, we have a definition of what a Jew is. Saying anybody of, you know, has a Jewish grandfather, when, you know, Russians were very used to fudging documents and doing what they needed to get ahead in a bureaucracy. There's no question that, you know, that the churches in Israel are booming. Much more than they ever were before because of the Russians that came over that are Russian Orthodox. Today in Israel, that Christmas exists. It never existed. When I was there 30 years ago, it didn't exist. Today it does because you have 500,000, you know, Russian people of Jewish descent who claim to be Jewish, who they came to Israel, and some people claim they're even anti-Semitic. Because they were just people that saw an opportunity to get out of Russia in that time, and a lot of people in Russia believe the Jews were rich, and so they hopped on the boat and they went to Israel, and they took all the freebies. Some of them went back after they used the. But there is this question about how accepting to be. Once they're accepted and they're part of the Jewish people, we have a mitzvah to love them. But it is part of, like I said, from our standpoint, though, we just have to see that. We are getting close. We're getting close to the end of the vision that Yeshayahu had about the future is taking place now, 1,000 years later. How about that? And so, to us, we it should increase our faith when we see that that's what happens. Yeah.
I just wanted to mention that people didn't know Ariel Hillenbrand, who was here. Yeah, she is from Germany. She came here, she converted, she moved back to Germany, she just recently got married, to a rabbi in Germany who was from Russia and who was not Jewish, but who converted and learned, and he's a rabbi.
Yeah. Interesting. I didn't know she was from Germany. Well,
yes. Yes.
That's very interesting. Okay, verse 2. Well, luckily, I mean, the other part of this is, how did we manage to bring all those Russian Jews to Israel? Even though Jews have a lot of money, we couldn't have done it on our own. It was done with loan guarantees by the former President Bush, and it was also done with the help of the Christian world. There's big organizations that spend millions of dollars helping Jews bring other Jews back. I forgot the name of the organization. They even have a rabbi as the head of one. I don't know what kind of rabbi he is. But there are Christian organizations that support bringing Jews back to Israel because, see, they're all hoping to, you know, that they'll have their second coming or whatever that is, so, you know, that they, but they, that's part of the prophecy that the Goyim will help bring us back. That's verse 2. Elohu Amin. And, people shall take them, that they'll be part of that process. They'll help bring the Jews back. Now, what are we going to do with these non-Jews that are there? So there will be non-Jews that will be there. So the lucky ones will get to be our servants and our maidservants. In other words, what are we going to do with all these non-Jews? Well, some of them will be able to put to use as servants and maidservants. What?
I just said they might not think they're lucky.
Oh, they might not think they're so lucky. Yeah, that's true.
You mentioned that we were just in Israel, and on the light post, they have menorahs all over town.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was just awesome.
Yes,
to
yeah.
To see that, mm-hmm. you know, after. And we never saw anything relating to the Christian
holiday. Oh, that's good. That's good.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like it didn't make sense.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's what I remember. Someone told me there are certain parts of the country where you can go to on the, you know, and it exists. But there's probably certain neighborhoods or things.
It's so nice to see Hanukkah decorations.
Mm-hmm. And you can see apartment buildings where you look all the way up and down. You see menorahs in every window. That's great. You know, it's coming from this country where you see other kinds of decorations. It's really, you know, it's a nice feeling. And they have the menorahs outside there, too. You see the lights outside. And that's very beautiful. So, basically the Gentiles, there'll be Gentiles that have a chance to convert, and they'll be part of the Jewish people, and then there'll be people that want to jump on the bandwagon in the future, and they will merit to serve the Jewish people. Occasionally you'll run into a non-Jew that considers it a blessing to work for, to do something for a Jew. There are places where that's preached, or at least I've been told that by an occasional non-Jew. You know, oh, I want to, you know, but v'hayu shavim l'shaveim, and we will be the Jewish people at that time when we were amongst the nations. We paid taxes to, and we served foreign kings, and now these countries that we were subservient to, we will rule over. But Yodu Benoksehem, and those that were our lords that bossed over us, now we will be in charge of them. That's part of the messianic blessing. In other words, if there were other nations that used to tell us what to do and were mean to us, in future times we will call the shots. Okay. V'haya b'yom heniyak Hashem l'cha me'atzvecha. Very interesting. It says that at that time Hashem will allow us to have no more sorrow. They'll have the exile is a time of sorrow. It's a time of darkness. When the messianic times come, we'll be able to put aside our sorrow. And our anger. It's interesting. He doesn't translate it. He calls it shuddering. But the word rogev to me is more anger. I don't know what your translation is. But
distress.
Veil.
Okay, yeah, it's distress, travail, shuddering. But I want to call it anger. But umin ha'avod ha'kasha, and most of all, the hard work. You know, all of us, some of us, it's at different times of our lives. But much of the exile, it was a challenge just to put bread on the table. You know, the Jews, the labor. You know, just to, especially when you know Jews kept Shabbos, and just to manage it worked. You know, it's work isn't easy. It's people struggle out there, and so in messianic times just like the Garden of Eden, where, you know, the fruits grew on the trees and everything was nice and easy. So in Messianic times also, we won't have to work so hard. That was a curse, that mankind would have to struggle to make ends meet. And so one of the blessings will be that, you know, we won't have to work so hard. So that's kind of, that's a short part of, you know, that's like one prophecy. Now, the book continues, Yeshayahu continues with a different prophecy. What about the kingdom that put us into exile to begin with, Babylonia? What's going to happen to them? So this is what he said. V'nasas ha-mashal azal melech bavel. You'll tell this to, this will be like an example or a story to the king of Babylonia. And the king of Babylonia, there was Nebuchadnezzar, and he was a quite an interesting ruler. He was a madman, basically. He thought he was a god. You know, if a person thinks they're God, then they are very abusive and very, we look at somebody like Assad or somebody like that. We don't really have, like, dictators with ultimate power, you know, who do whatever they want and but you read about people like that, you know, and that was the king of Babel. And, it'll say, Marta, and you will say to him, Ek Shavas Nogesh. The one that liked to be the boss, that's going to be no more. That's going to end. Shavsa Madheva, and the arrogant one, that's going to end. Shover Hashem Matzavish, Hashem's going to break your stick. The stick is what a person leans on, and describes the stick of the wicked. So Hashem's going to break that stick. Shave it Moshlim. And these rulers who used to, you know, you look at, again, Assad is probably the perfect, you know, example of just a madman that just, you know, doesn't care about his people, just worried about his own power and, you know, just, but there was a time in history where there were a number of cruel rulers. Africa's like that, you know, these cruel, call it a despot, is that the name? Like a cruel ruler, and so he's describing, now, what did he do that was so bad? The answer is, verse 6, Maka Ami Bever, he'd get angry, he'd just wipe out peoples. You know, he would just, Stalin was like that, you know, he'd get angry, you know, all of a sudden he would send a certain group of people to Siberia. There's a list of, like, Alexander Solzhenitsyn has a book, and he described, the Gulag Archipelago, that's the name of the book, of the Gulag was the name of where they sent all the Soviet prisoners. And so there were different nations that Stalin would, at different times, just decide, you know, can't trust them, let's send them all to Siberia. Let's send them all to the work camps. And they would just uproot a whole state of people and ship them up to the, and most of them would die on the way to the camps or couldn't relocate. And it was just it didn't really faze him to take whole nations and uproot them. The truth is Europe did that throughout the Middle Ages. The Germans would get rid of the French, and the French would uproot the Germans, and then the Russians would uproot the Germans, and whenever they had a war, they would uproot the peoples that were in the way of their boundaries. That was just a very cruel ruler does that, just doesn't care about the fate of whole peoples. But that's a Maka Amin Be'evra. This king, the Babylonian king, if he got angry, that was it. He would, whole nations he would hit. Makas Bilti Sara, and when he would hit, he wouldn't stop. There's some nations that like need to show off their power, so they do a demonstration, but then they let go. This Babylonian king, he just kept at it. Roda Be'af Goyim Merudas Bli Choshev. He would wipe them out, and he wouldn't take pity. He was the most brutal of the brutal. Verse 7. When he was wiped out, Nachashach the Koloritz, Tatsurino, and when he goes, everybody's going to be happy. Everybody's going to be, it's like a new life when you get rid of a dictator like that. Now, even Gabaroshim Samkula, even the trees will be happy when he goes. and the cedar trees, because people wouldn't cut them down. Whenever somebody got too powerful, they'd be cut down by these rulers. They couldn't stand any opposition. They were always afraid of people. Verse 9, Sheol mitachtes ragzalach, Gehenim is waiting to receive the king of Babylonia. It's just waiting. It's it's opening up underneath him. Likras boyacha. It's very interesting, very poetic language. But he created this Gehenna in his mind. Oh, you know, he's serving Hashem and he was divine right, and you know. But the Gehenna or lecha refoim kol atude or tekim mikisam. This person, he used to arouse all the other kingdoms. Kol malchei goyim. He was such a ruler, he made the other nations like bow down to him. The other rulers bowed down to him. Verse 10. Kulam yanu v'yomrei lecha. The other nations who he used to boss around, they will be shocked that when they see his downfall. They'll say, Gamata chulesi kimoni. He says, look, even you. Basically, there's an idea that all of the wicked are going to be punished in Gehenna. And they have a special place there. You know, Hitler has a special place. They're burning down there, slow roasting. When the king of Babylonia comes to join them, they're going to say, oh, you joined the club. You know, you're here. Elena Nimshalton. 11. Hurat Shogunecha. Your pride, you arrogant one, you're going to join all of those people. The Gehenim. Hemayis nevlecha tachtecha, yutsu rima machosecha toleya. You'll be down there with the worms and the maggots and the king who lived in the finest, used to the finest things. He's going to fall. 12. Eik nasalta mishamayim helu ben shachar. It's almost describing like somebody who is in the high heavens is going to fall down. Nigla eretz cholish al goyim. You are going to fall down, who was like the highest of people. Nebuchadnezzar, what he used to do is all the nations around him were subservient to him. He used to throw lots, and he would summon the leaders to him, and he used to sodomize them, the different leaders. And it was part of the, I don't know whether that was his way of subduing them or his perversion, but the other kings were very happy to see him go. Vata martuveha shemaima, you and your haughtiness said you will go up to the heavens. This is Nebuchadnezzar, he thought he was going to rule over, that he was going to fight against God. He was above it all. He was above El Arim Kisev Eshim Bahar Moed. He was going to dwell amongst all the other things. Verse 14, Allah Abam Seyav, he said he's going to be in the clouds. Adam Le'elyon, he was the divine. So he thought he was a god, but you know what? Verse 15, Achal Shol Torid, he's going straight to Gehenna. He's not going up, he's going down. Yarksebor. Again, a very poetic, very... it paints a certain picture, you know, of the, you know, this arrogant ruler who thought he was divine and thought he was higher than the heavens. In the end, he's going to be lowered down, is going to be punished for what he has done. Roi melecha yeshkichu elecha. People are going to look at you. Yisbonen hazeh ish margiz oris. This was a person who everybody was afraid of. Kingdoms were afraid. Shum Tebel Kamidbar, he would turn countries into deserts. Arv Haras, he would destroy cities. The power that this guy had is incredible. Asir Lo Pasuk Beso, he took prisoners of all the nations, he never let them out. Most people take prisoners for a short amount of time. He had prisons where he locked people up, and it says, well, plus he never, once they were locked up, they never got out. All of the nations would come to him with honor to show respect. To me, it sounds a lot like Stalin, to be honest. You know, like the ruler like that. You know, people would come and they would bow down to him and go out of their way. Everybody would bring honor. 19. Not only was he sent to Gehenna, but even his physical body was taken out of the grave. What happened was, he had gone insane, which I guess could happen. Maybe he was insane to begin with. And his son took over the country. And then he came back and he had his son tortured. So that when he died, or when people said he died, I'm not sure if it's the next son or the same son, said that he was not going to fall for that trick again. But sometimes kings would pretend to die. Stalin did this to see how people would act when they thought he wasn't around.
Okay.
So therefore what he insisted was that he would only take over if they would bring him his father's body. And so make sure it was dead. And so they dug up his... it just wants to show that he didn't even rest in peace. Let's put it that way. Like that's like the at least the dignity that you know that you know that his body rest in peace. That he didn't have that. He's going to be thrown out of your grave. Kaneta nitov, like something disgusting. Lavush harugim mate charev, and the all the people that he had killed, you know, would he would be in his body. He really would not rest. Yored alav nebor kapeger muvas. He would be like roadkill. 20. Lo secha ritem bekvura. You won't even have a decent resting place. Your memory. Some people they worry about their legacy. That's not. There's no legacy for this one. Kiarta shichas. You know what? You destroyed your land. Abka. You killed your own people. Lo yikra la olam zera mereim. People will never have. You won't have descendants. You won't have future rulers. Hakinu lebana matbeah, your kids will be destroyed. This king, this Nebuchadnezzar, is going to be totally wiped out. Ba yukum of yosharot umolo pnei tevel orim, and the cities would be wiped out. The kamte leim nu mashem so the karti lebavo shame usher v'nin v'neked. Hashem said there'll be no remnant. Most kingdoms they go away, and there's other countries that their descendants are still there. The kingdom of Babylonia was totally wiped out. There's nothing there. What's interesting, even in Iraq, if you go to the area, they have these ancient kingdoms. They know where his palace is. It's in a desert. It's not in the area. It's like totally, like, it's hard to believe that at one time this was the capital city and this was the palace. It's like a bunch of ruins. That's what he's describing. And it says this here, that this would happen. 23. Hashem says, I'm going to turn that area of the, what would happen to Nebuchadnezzar. And he's saying that the area of his capital and his legacy and his country, Hashem's going to make it into a swamp. And the Hebrew here is Zetitesiha v'matate. It's going to, it's like he's going to sweep it away. Mm. It's like the whole kingdom is going to be, in a very short time, this country is just going to be wiped away. In some way, that's what happened with Rome when the hordes of Genghis Khan came and wiped out. Like, you know, it's hard to believe when you're in a country or in a place in its power that it's going to be gone. You know, like the so he believed that he would last forever and his kingdom would last forever, and in a very short time he was going to be totally swept away. And that's Hashem is going to v'titesa b'mateya. He's going to be swept with a sweeper, hashmed, totally shmad, totally wiped out. New Hashem's focus. And you might say maybe Hashem will change his mind. Exactly what I'm telling you, this is the way it's going to be. It's not going to change. And Hashem's going to wipe out. Now we'll stop here on 25. So in other words, Babylonia is not going to is going to be punished for their role and for the terrible things they did and for what the kingdom of Babylonia stood for. Next week we'll deal with Usher, which is another ancient kingdom.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.